This is Diane Magris from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine.
Adolescence was not the easiest times for writer Richard Ford, but he struggled through it and used it as fodder for his later work. One of the results was that he won both the Penn Faulkner Award and the Pulitzer Prize for his 1996 novel, Independence Day. Ford was raised in the rich literary delta of the American South, but now lives in Midcoast Maine, where he wrote a sequel to Independence Day called Lay of the Land. He's been called the most original and most traditional of American writers, and he likes that description.
The stories that I liked the best when I was a kid, and when I was a young man learning to read, a kid learning to read, were traditional stories, Frank O'Connor, Sherwood Anderson, things that would be thought of as traditional stories, realistic stories. When it says tree, you think tree. That's, I liked that. It was long after that that I began to think that when I read literature in the 70s, William Gass, that language was a kind of object in and of itself to me. Though I think that in my life I was able to make those two sort of strains in literature go together.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your early years, because every biography I've read of you, every little blurb, always brings in the traveling salesman. Now, is this because you always bring him in? How important is it?
Well, he was my father, so that's pretty important.
Yeah.
And he was gone a lot, so that was important. And I was at home alone with my mother for years, because he was gone from Monday morning to Friday afternoon. And so I was an only child. And so how important is one's childhood? It's what you make of it, I suppose. The most important thing about my childhood, irrespective of what my father did for a living, was that it was a wonderful childhood. My parents loved me. I didn't have any brothers or sisters to compete with. When my father came home on Friday, he was always really happy. And then by the time the weekend was over, he was really happy to go back out on the road because he loved his job. So the fact that he was a traveling salesman, I don't know what that is meant to mean. There were times in the summer, because my mother was taking care of me, when I would basically be shunted off with him. I would go with him on his sales routes.
Boy stuff.
Mm-hmm. And it was always interesting to me, and I don't know if it would be interesting to anybody else, but my mother and I, actually all three of us, were a lot alike, which is to say we had terrible tempers. and when we were together, the three of us, it could be stormy. But I don't mean to say that it was unhappy, but people, popped. But when my father and I were together and we were in his car, this little, whatever it was, 1952 Mercury, driving around the Atchafalaya Basin in Louisiana, we never passed a crossword. And I don't think it was so much because we were on our best behavior, though we were on our best behavior. I think it seemed like such a unique experience for both of us to be alone with each other, that we just simply accommodated each other.
It had to have been, then, a horrible jolt when he had a heart attack, and then you found yourself more often in Arkansas with your grandfather?
Yes. Well, it was a horrible jolt to be 16 and have your father die in your arms. There's no doubt about that. And with my mother kind of going hysterical right in front of me. But I'll tell you something. I was in trouble with the police at the time, and I was getting into all kinds of scrapes and fights and stealing and things like that, because I was just a little punk is what I was. and when my father died, my mother said to me, I can't take care of you anymore as I have taken care of you. And you're going to have to take care of yourself, so if you land in jail, I'm not going to get you out. If you get in trouble, I'm not going to bail you. And the effect of my father dying was, in essence, to do two things at once. It sort of set me free, because my mother wasn't going to look out for me anymore, and he wasn't going to be around. And then it also made me responsible for myself in a way that mitigated that sense of sort of chaotic freedom, which might have descended on me.
And yet you did flirt with all kinds of other things besides writing. You went to law school a little bit. You did sports writing. Yeah.
Yeah, I did all those things. But I,
why?
Well, because I wasn't very skillful. That's probably dyslexic and not a particularly good reader. And I didn't have any parental guidance. Nobody in my family had been to college or done anything. They grew up in the Depression. And so when it came time for me to sort of decide what I wanted to do, I didn't have anybody around to tell me what was the right thing to do. I mean, there wasn't that sense that you got to succeed.
But that theme is so ever present in your work, as your hero is continually trying to figure out what success is and what failure is. The sports writer is a perfect place to start with that, because
Absolutely.
Here you have a novel. It's the ironies just turn on themselves, this whole point, because you had been writing sports.
Yes.
Journalism, right?
I had been because my life, my writing life had pretty much come to a dead end in about 1981. And I just I called up my agent and I said, this ain't working anymore.
You mean your fiction writing?
Yes,
yeah.
Writing. I'd written two novels. I said, this isn't working anymore. I said, would you get me a job? And so he got me a job, a regular stand-up adult job.
Mm-hmm.
Which I didn't.
Which you didn't think you had had before when you were writing novels. That wasn't a job.
It took me a long time as a young writer to get out of that feeling that when I was staying home and Christina was going to school or going
Christina,
to work.
Christina, your wife.
My wife. took me a long time to get over that feeling of discomfort about not going out for a job.
Mm.
But I got over it as one can.
Because remember, the traveling salesman did go out, literally.
Go out.
Yeah.
Work was a big thing in our
right.
life. I always
right.
worked. So it took me a long time to get over not going to the job. Eventually, I got over it.
Mm-hmm.
And then my writing life came to a stop, and I had to go out and do it again, which was fine. I always thought I would have made a great employee.
Huh.
But it hasn't worked out that way.
You're your own employee.
Well,
but what's great about the sports writer is that here we have a failed novelist as a hero who
yes.
turns to sports writing. That book seems to me to give a lie to the idea that you're a failed novelist, because it was a successful novel,
yeah.
right? And it took you back into the world of fiction
it
writing?
Did. It did, indeed. I will tell you what the provenance of that book was, which was that the magazine I was working for in New York, which was called Inside Sports and was owned by Newsweek, went out of business. And I came back to Princeton where Christina and I were living, and I didn't have any work anymore.
So you were a failed sports writer.
I was just notching up another
just the
failure.
Opposite.
And I said, well, I guess I'm going to have to fall back on what I know how to do, which is to write novels. And Christina said, well, why don't you write a novel about somebody who's happy? And which was a bolt out of the blue.
Literally novel, actually, for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, what would make a person happy? And when I had stopped being a novelist and started writing sports, I realized that in a conventional sense, I had kind of gone down a rung from, and I thought, gee, going down a rung made me so glad, it made me so happy. And maybe that would be a thing a person could do to make himself happy, which is to quit being this thing which was not working for him or hard or amorphous and also unsuccessful. And go down to something that you could do with some pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always liked that idea. Every time I finish a book, I always think to myself, now's the time to go down a rung.
Wow, you're not going down a rung now, are you?
Well, I'm just finishing a book this week, so I'll be in such probably a kind of a miasmic daze for a while. I won't know what to do.
So let's talk about that book. Just fast forward to it.
It's called The Lay of the Land. And it's a novel that is in sequence with two other novels that I wrote, one called, as you mentioned, The Sports Writer, and another called Independence Day. And it has to do with the same character whose name is Frank Bascom and who lives in New Jersey and sells real estate. Selling real estate was, for Frank, the kind of coming down a notch, which he did after being a sports writer. So
I love the idea of having you read from this book that nobody's seen yet.
Yeah, I'd love to.
That's a news story now.
It is.
Yeah.
This is just a little passage out of the middle of the book, which involves Frank Bascom, who narrates this story, driving in his car on the way to see his ex-wife, who has something important to tell him. He is filled with trepidation. Possibly it's a side effect of the millennium, which doesn't seem to have other effects. Or else it's my recent indisposed passage of life, but often these days I'm thunderstruck by the simplest, most commonplace events or non-events, as if the regular known world had suddenly illuminated itself with a likable freshness, rendering me pleased. Geniuses must experience this every day, with great inventions and discoveries the happy results. Isn't this how birds fly? Too bad we can't. If you just rounded off the sides of that granite block, you could maybe move it a mite easier, and so forth. My recent fresh realizations were on the order of being amazed that someone thought to put a yellow light in between the green and red ones, or that everybody takes the road from Haddam to Trenton for granted, but nobody thinks what a stroke of brilliance it was to build the first road.
You could have created a hero with the same plot, the same set of events in his life, who would have ended that book on a very dark note, or written in a very dark voice.
Yes.
But you don't.
No, and I think that had something to do with getting older, and it had something to do with having the opportunity to think long and hard about what good literature is to the people who read it. I know when I wrote those two novels and they didn't get me anywhere, didn't find a lot of readers, to write the third one, which was The Sports Writer, I really had to do something to myself which I hadn't done before. I had to bump up my game in a really considerable way. And one of the ways that I bumped up my game was to think, I want to write a book that someone, in the sense that Walter Benjamin talks about, that someone can use, which is to say a book that when you read it will, in some way, not because it has a happy ending, but because of the passage that the reader experiences when she or he passes through the book, that will in some way redeem you. That the access to art, that the access to language, that it will be felicitous, that it will be funny, that it will have things to give you. And so that really became something I wanted to do a lot.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.